Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles. I am Maureen Enner, your Northern California connection.
Hey, good afternoon, San Francisco. My name is Bob Lang, your Southern California connection.
Together we are your California connection. How's it going down there, Bob?
I'm doing great, Maureen. We got a nice long weekend coming up. We got President's Day. Today is Lincoln's birthday, one of our finest presidents ever. 207 years old he would be today. So one of our greatest presidents of all time.
So that was the first president you voted for?
No, he was the second one.
I remember those caucuses. They were it was the Lincoln Douglas debate. I was a debate champion in high school. You know, I studied Lincoln Douglas debate. Oh, come on. You're younger than me. Bob Lang, CNBC star with Jim Cramer, Mad Money, and what a week it's been on the markets. How are you doing? I worry about you because, you know, I'm not in the game anymore.
I'm doing great.
I'm
doing great. You know what? Actually, we did off the charts over the early on in the week on Tuesday, and he covered the stocks that I helped him coin the phrase FANG, which...
Excellent segment you did.
Thank you very much. The FANG stocks, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google, the stocks everybody hates to love and loves to hate. So that was a lot of fun. It was a pretty well widely watched segment, and the show was real strong and really had a lot of fun. We did that the day before Jim Cramer's birthday, which was on Wednesday. That was a lot of fun.
Great. Well, you know, I found it interesting. You posted posted the UPS chart the other day, and we were talking about UPS at Christmas and wondering why Amazon was doing so well and UPS and FedEx were not. So, what's the end result? What are you looking at after the holiday with UPS?
I don't know. I don't know the reason for that either. I think, you know, Amazon obviously does a ton of business, mostly with FedEx these days, a little less so with UPS. But I think the problem is that a lot of these other retailers, you know, it's six in one, half a dozen in the other. It's not like the whole business is expanding for everybody. I mean, what Amazon is taking is share away from other people, other companies like a Walmart or a Target or a Nordstrom's or a Macy's or any of these other companies that have online business. They're just, you know, it's zero sum game. You know, they're taking money away, and it's not like UPS or FedEx's business is expanding. They're just, you know, they're just taking more of Amazon's business away from all these other retailers. So, you know, what's good for Amazon may not necessarily be good for anybody else.
Well, you know, we just recently moved my husband and I to a new home. We have a pool. I haven't had a pool since I was a teenager living with my parents. Mm-hmm. My husband bought all of our pool supplies on Amazon. It was pennies compared to going to a local pool supply company. So I just see Amazon being Amazon. They are just going to take over everything. My husband even orders his protein bars, and, you know, we're always on these, you know, we're very healthy eaters and we eat certain things. And he orders it now all on Amazon. It's cheaper than in the store, and it's delivered free. So it's a no-brainer.
Yep.
So UPS
absolutely.
Has to be doing well because of that.
I'm sure they're doing well because of that. But again, it's not necessarily an expansion of business. It's mostly taking business away from other companies. And then there's this other company in China called Alibaba. If you've heard of them, they're kind of like the Amazon of China and the Southeast Asia part. They did the same thing. I mean, you know, I have some people who I know who buy all their stuff through Alibaba for, you know, a fraction of what it would cost at a regular retail store. So, you know, it's not, you know, secondhand stuff either. It's first rate goods. So, you know, the online stores are definitely the way to go. I mean, I did most of my shopping for the holidays for Amazon. I think you'd said, you know, you did as well too. Mm-hmm. I mean, through, you know.
That was my expertise in the industry was, I was, you know, selling research to hedge fund managers,
right.
And so the sector that I covered was retail. So I follow the retail numbers very, very strongly, and We had discussed that, you know, people are not going out to the mall. They're shopping on Amazon. But anyways, congratulations. Always love to see you when you get on CNBC. It's a big thing for both of us. And so, yeah, you had a good week, but the market was pounding you. I know it was stressful for you. I was stressed for you.
Thank you. Let me ask a lot of volatility.
Yeah. Well, and you're such an expert trader. You are the kind of person that can, you know, you can do it all. I like I say, I bow down to you. I'm just a man of white. So where were you in the summer of 1995? What were you doing?
I was finishing up my master's degree, and I was delivering cookies. Well, not delivering them, but I was a sales rep for Keebler, and for about three years, I was a Keebler elf, and I was selling cookies, crackers, and salty snacks to all the grocery stores. I started in a my territory was in South Central LA. Then I moved out to the San Fernando Valley, and then I had the west side of LA and Malibu and that area, and then I moved on to bigger and better things after I got my master's degree. So yeah, I was a little Keebler elf. I didn't dress up like an elf though, but I mean, I might as well could have.
Hey, that's a big story. You were a Keebler elf, and now you're on CNBC with Jim Cramer. I mean, that's more of a success story than I have.
Well, so anyway, where were you in 1995?
So, actually, in 1994 is when this happened, but that summer or that whole year that captivated the entire world. And what we are talking about today is the O.J. Simpson trial. And I was married to my first husband. My children were small. And I remember vividly waking up and turning on the television. It was summer. And Matt Lauer coming on saying that the bodies of two people were found dead in Brentwood. One was the ex-wife of O.J. Simpson. I'll never forget that. And I remember thinking, that's weird. This is weird. You know, it struck a chord with me.
Maureen, do you know what street I lived on when I grew up in West Los Angeles? It was Bundy Drive. Yes, I
no
did.
No way.
I lived. I lived on Bundy Drive, Bundy in Idaho. I lived 1 mile away from the Ralphs, which was right across the street from the condo where Nicole and Ron Goldman were killed. Across the street from Ralph's.
Wow.
Yep, 1 mile away.
I know it because my ex-husband and I did the whole tour. We drove down, we went to the Metzaluna, we went to her house, we timed it to see if he could do it because they were actually giving like tours. But anyways, let's not let our precious guests sit here listening to us because we could go on all day. John Gibson, Fox News radio star, long time broadcast success. I had no idea till I listened to one of his podcasts or his radio shows that he worked for Atlantic Records. He's a record executive. John covered the trial for 18 months. John, welcome to California Connection with Maureen and Bob. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
So take us back. You were working at NBC in LA, in Burbank, right? At a television station?
I was working for NBC News. I was on the Burbank lot I guess it's still there, in the bureau right above the Jay Leno studio, and I was a correspondent for NBC News.
So tell me, when did you first hear? Was it something that, I mean, were you there the moment that it broke, or when? Tell us about how you heard about it and what you did.
Well, as I recall events, it was one of the fact that those bodies were found, and one of them was the wife of O.J. Simpson, was, it was a bit of news. It was rattling around the bureau, and the Simon editor following whatever the developments were and so forth. And I was... And I can't remember if anybody was going to be doing the story for NBC or if they decided to put it on the budget for nightly news that night, but gone down to the parking lot, and I drove out of the parking lot on my way a few blocks away to pick up my dry cleaning, and I was listening to KNX, and I heard O.J. Simpson is in handcuffs. And I wheeled around a U-turn, went back to the bureau, and within, I don't know, 15 minutes, I was doing the first of what ended up being about 10,000 live shots on the story. So the story didn't really have what we call legs until it was clear that somebody thought O.J. did it, and they actually put him in cuffs and were putting him under arrest.
So have you watched the miniseries, Bob? Have either of you watched the first two episodes?
I haven't watched it.
I have not. I have no interest in... I have an aversion to seeing television or film historical revisionism of things I've lived through. So I have no interest in watching it. And as a matter of fact, I've been in contact, Arden and Rock Harmon, among a couple others that were, you know, involved in the case, and they're not watching it either.
I read an article that Marcia Clark she had a very hard time watching the first two episodes. Is that, you know, that I didn't realize, I read an article about Marcia Clark. She was the lead prosecutor for the Los Angeles, you know, district attorney's office. She never practiced law after that. She said she lost all her faith in the criminal justice system after that trial.
Well, one could imagine. I met Judge Ito all these years later out at Santa Anita. And he, you know, he was very nice and friendly. And he said, give me a call sometime when you're in town and we'll have lunch. And next time I was back in L.A., I called and there was no return call, no response. And I realized, yeah, Judge Ito, coming up on the 20th anniversary of this thing, has no interest whatsoever in speaking to anybody who was a reporter. So he also is evidently not too interested in watching it either.
John, let me ask you a question. Do you believe, maybe as I do, that perhaps the attorneys, Chris Darden and Marcia Clark and anybody else, they were a bit complacent in thinking that perhaps thinking that all the evidence is pointing to it being so obvious, he's got to be guilty. Were they complacent and they didn't, and that's where they possibly failed?
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, maybe complacent's the word. I think that it was a matter of overkill. They were going to put together a case that nailed it down an avalanche of detail, which led to the thing being so long and making the jurors so bitter and resentful. The jurors are essentially in prison for a year, and there was a period when they were doing the DNA evidence that Marcia, as the lead prosecutor, didn't appear before the jury for a really long time. I have a feeling it was something like 2 months. And that was when Barry Shack and his guys from the Innocence Project were up questioning the DNA evidence, and Rock Harmon and his partner were up for the prosecution. And it just took the wind out of the sails of the prosecution. I mean, Marcia was disconnected from the jury by the time she finally came back. So I'm not sure they were complacent so much as that they just thought that this massive case was going to make it impossible for anything but a guilty verdict. And in fact, it worked the other way around.
You know, I did watch the miniseries, and I watched episode 1 and 2, and I plan on watching all of them. I just haven't had time to, you know, they're on my DVR. But the interesting thing in episode 1, a lot of things came out that are proven to be true that only an attorney should know. I heard a couple, Dershowitz was on with Megyn Kelly, and he was explaining this, that how did it get out, and now it's in a miniseries, that he failed his lie detector test. He got a negative 24, which is the worst you can do. How did that information get leaked? What I really am curious about, John, is take us back to a time when there was no internet, no way. You were literally having to chase lease, how much truth came to you via your sources and how much was not true? How much did you really know that you were not able to talk about, I guess, is what I want to know.
Well, look, for starters, I have to, you know, tell you what I was doing, which was I was working for the NBC feed service, which meant I did live shots for all of the stations across the country that were NBC affiliates. And right from the very first moments, all of them were calling and booking live shots. So I was doing live shots. Most of the time I was doing live shots every 5 minutes, one after another, as the clock marched through the time zone. So at 9 o'clock in the morning, I'd do noon shots for the East Coast, and then it would go on till, you know, it was noon out here, and I was on the West Coast. I was doing live shots for the West Coast stations, and then it would get to be, 3 o'clock on the West Coast, which is 5 and 6 on the East, and so forth. They couldn't get enough of it. So basically, I was tied down doing live shots with all of the resources of NBC News coming to me. So we had, you know, feeds coming in from all of the crews who were out covering things. We had information coming to us that was discovered by NBC reporters, including NBC News there in L.A., and any of the people that came in from out of town. And I was more of a recipient of all the information that was gathered by others rather than me going out and developing sources of my own. I full confession, I never set foot in the courtroom. I was always on this scaffolding in the parking lot across the street from the criminal courts building that was 40 feet in the air. And I would sit there in a chair, one of those director's chairs, and do a live shot, maybe have a few minutes till the next one. I'd update a script, new information come in, new video would come in. You got to remember, there was just the whole thing being a circus. There was just all kinds of weird stuff coming in at all times. As for, you know, information like that, that he failed the lie detector test or that he got a certain, what you describe as the worst score you could get, I seem to remember we knew that his lie detector test was very funky and he didn't pass it. I didn't know anything about the specifics about how badly he failed it. There was always kind of a flood of information from lawyers who had sources in the courthouse, and they would tell somebody and then they'd tell a reporter, and then a reporter would put it out. And so I was more of a clearinghouse of everybody's general information about the case rather than a guy running around wearing out shoe leather, finding stuff on my own.
Exactly. So different time, right? Different way of covering a story.
Sorry, my dog.
Oh, that's good. Go ahead, Bob. What were you going to say?
No problem. So, John, I'd heard some stories that it seemed that the defense won the case when the jury consultant came out there and selected jurors. As you know, there was a big racial case out here where I live out here in Simi Valley with the officers and Rodney King, and the trial of those police officers was out here in Simi Valley. I really don't know why it was in Simi, because it's in Ventura County, but I guess it's because it's close to where that beating occurred with Rodney King. And a lot of people out there were upset with the verdict out here, and they were going to get, you know, they used this OJ case to, quote unquote, get back at the, you know, white police officers for being acquitted. Some people say that the jury consultant, the tall blonde woman, I can't remember what her name was, but I guess she was hired by Johnny Cochran, basically
Joe
won the case with
Demetrius.
That's right. Okay, that's her. That basically they won the case with her selection of jurors because she somewhat knew who to pick, who were going to side with them on the verdict. Is that right?
Bob, they show that in the miniseries. They show the whole selection. And the jury comes back, none of them liked Marshall Clark. So they had that was like a slam dunk right there before the trial even started, in my opinion. Mm-hmm.
So that's true. Do you believe that, John?
Would you agree?
Well, I have a different view of it. I'm sure she did a good job. She was really good at it. I kind of knew her. She was dating one of the guys who worked at NBC, so I'd hear little things, this and that. But I think that what happened was, now this is a little complicated, but I'll tell you, and I've told this story many times before. It's not as though it's a new revelation, but I've really never heard anybody paying any attention to it. In the beginning, when even before the trial started, I think it was during the preliminary hearing, NBC, Tom Brokaw was anchoring Nightly News, and he had two people in the bureau through the afternoon. Remember, Nightly News comes on at 3 o'clock or is done at 3 o'clock in L.A. So Johnny Cochran and Ira Reiner were his two special guests who would come on together and talk about what was going to be happening. And they were sitting just outside my office in the bureau, and I would listen to Johnny Cochran, watch Johnny Cochran while I was doing live shots in the live shot position in the bureau, and he was on the phone. It was the days before internet, but we had cell phones. And it was clear to me he was talking to O.J. in jail. And I heard him say a couple times, not yet, just wait. Well, then what happened was the Urban League in Los Angeles, the head of the Urban League was a guy called John Mack, and he demanded a meeting with Gil Garcetti, the district attorney, to come meet with community leaders. And they wanted the trial downtown rather than in Santa Monica where the crime happened. So when Gil Garcetti went to the Urban League to meet with John Mack and community leaders, one of those community leaders was Johnny Cochran. So Johnny Cochran orchestrates this meeting. He gets Gil Garcetti to agree that the trial will be held downtown. Obviously, they wanted black jurors. And after that was set, then Johnny Cochran joined the defense team. So after he had maneuvered the case downtown where he was sure to get black jurors, whereas if it was in Santa Monica, it would be very unlikely he'd get the lecturers. Once he had that set, he joined the defense team. Now, the other thing you got to remember, and maybe Bob remembers this from his youth in L.A., is there was a case years before that, a guy named Ron Settles, who was a football player. I think with USC.
And he was Cal State Long Beach, I think.
Right. Okay. So he got arrested in Seal Beach. He died in a cell. And the Seal Beach Police Department said he hanged himself in his cell. And Johnny Cochran proved in court that Seal Beach police had beat him to death.
Mm-hmm.
So Johnny Cochran, and there were other cases. There was a woman named Love, Eula Love, I think, who was shot by some L.A. County Sheriff. In any case, Johnny was a big hero in the black community for prosecuting the police when they abused black people, killed them. And when Johnny entered the courtroom with whatever that number was, six middle-aged black jurors, it was vouching for O.J. It's just his presence was vouching for O.J. Oh, there's Johnny Cochran. He's on the defense team. We already believe him before he even opens his mouth. And then, of course, the whole Furman thing came up. And the way the blood evidence was handled with Lang and Van Atter. And it all of that maneuvering had the effect of teeing up that jury to acquit. And when they did acquit, it was no surprise to me.
Do you think the jury already had their decision made without even sitting through the trial?
Well, not really, but I just think that probably what happened was, in the minds of the black jurors, the fact that Johnny had joined the defense team opened up the possibility that this was going to be a case in which the police set up O.J. Simpson. And then, you know, the gloves, lots of other things that occurred during the trial slowly set that in their mind, and it led to that result. And by the way, as I said earlier, I think it was an abuse of the jury to keep them sequestered like they were for so long, imprisoned, away from their family, their relatives. It really sounded like torture. They were fed well. They lived in a nice hotel, but they were taken on these sort of group excursions to Disneyland and to things like that, Universal City up there. But it was all just putting a ball and chain around these people. And I think they had a strong resentment of the way that thing stretched out so long, and that the consideration Ito gave to procedure and law over the consideration of the comfort of the jurors, it must have had a big effect as well.
John, do you think that Cato Kalin was honest with what he said in his testimony, that he didn't know?
That he didn't know.
You gotta watch the miniseries, Bob. You gotta watch it. they talk about that too.
Like John says, we lived through the whole thing. It's just crazy to have to live through it all again. You know, he saw everything up close. But
the interesting side of the miniseries is somebody talked. Somebody leaked this information. It's based on a book, which I'd actually like to read the book. But did Kardashian say something on his deathbed that it is now leaked out? I mean, John, how do you think these – you haven't watched the miniseries. We learned about the failing the lie detector. We learned about how he tried to commit suicide. We learned about how – Shapiro hit him in his house and got him out before the police came to arrest him. Remember when he didn't show up at 11 a.m.? I mean, they showed a lot of things that, and have been verified that they are true. These things did happen. So who cares now, really? Both of those attorneys are dead, and he's a felon locked up in Las Vegas. But how do you think the information got out, John? How do you think that it's all come out?
Well, okay, so look, the miniseries is based on the book by Jeffrey Toobin called The Run for His Life, or Run of His Life, right?
Yes.
And I didn't read the book, but I know Toobin is a good reporter. He's still on the air, works for ABC. He's a lawyer. He writes in legal publications, and I'm sure that Shapiro and Kardashian and Gerald Ullman and God knows who else on that team, or for that matter, even the prosecution team, talked to Jeffrey Toobin. I'm assuming that's where that information came from. And I would think that it's pretty solid coming from Toobin if it came out of his book.
Very riveting. I can understand you wouldn't want to watch the whole thing, but I highly recommend anybody watching the first two episodes because it gives a totally different perspective, because we are seeing what OJ did and what he went through. And it's pretty convincing that he killed her. I mean, I believe it wholeheartedly he killed her, but they talk about the Cato Kalin incident. I mean, it was very, very shocking. And that's why we brought you on, because people are now talking about it after all these years because of the miniseries. And one of the things that's been in question is, wow, you know, a lot of personal information was leaked over the time period, and we're learning about it. But does anybody care? Does OJ have any rights anymore? I mean, what can anybody do, right?
Well, he doesn't have any rights anymore. I mean, look, I only have one question in this thing, and that is, where is the knife? That is the one remaining mystery that would explain a lot, and the fact that it was gone and never found is really unbelievable. And the only explanation is that he did dump it at the airport, and that it ended up in a garbage bag and ended up in a landfill. But it's to me, it's the one remaining mystery of the whole saga.
Now, in the miniseries, I have to say, I'm very detailed. I watch everything. He left. The limo driver picked him up. He was late because he was murdering his wife. So when he walked into the limo, he was carrying Louis Vuitton luggage. When he came home from Chicago in the miniseries, he didn't have that luggage. He had something different. So I'm thinking, maybe he did throw that bag in the garbage in the airport, like they suspected. It went to the LAX garbage dump.
Yeah, I mean, look, there was a lot of testimony about that. I mean, they were out there somewhere in East L.A. where that landfill is, you know, looking it over and saying, how would we ever go through all of this? And they tried to get people like skycaps at the airport who might have seen something, the driver who might have seen something. They went to extreme lengths to try to find that thing. And, you know, eventually just plain gave up. It was impossible.
Yeah, yeah. Well, do you remember when they had, you know, they had the preliminary, I guess they call it the preliminary hearing to show there was enough evidence to bring it to trial. And it was a female judge. She wore the pearls. I can't remember her name. But it was on a Friday, and it was before the 4th of July weekend, and they had the envelope. Remember the envelope? Nobody ever found out to this day what was in the envelope. That's another reason why I want to watch the miniseries. Do you remember that, John, when everybody was held on edge on that Friday afternoon, and she was presented with that manila envelope?
You're bringing it back to me. I remember there was something about an envelope, but I don't remember now what it was.
Yeah, it was never talked about. It was a Friday. It was just never talked about. So obviously it wasn't the murder weapon because they would have, you know, had it. But to this day, I've never found out what was in the envelope. And I remember just everybody on edge that weekend. We couldn't wait to turn on the news on Tuesday because it was a long weekend to see what was in the envelope.
Well, I just say it wasn't that it wasn't talked about. All of those details were talked about constantly. But remember that the thing about this trial was that no question ever lasted more than a couple of days because a new question arose. Mm. And so, you know, there'd be an envelope controversy. What was in the envelope? Well, you'd sort of be talking about it for a couple of days, and then, oops, something else happened, and then it'd get left in the dust. So, yeah, I remember there was a controversy about an envelope, but I can't even remember what it was. I have the files on the trial. I've been carting them around all these years. They're in my storage building. And a couple of years ago, just as a digression, I called up Furman and said, hey, the 20th anniversary is coming up. I got all this stuff. You think we can do something with it? I don't know, book or write a script or something. And he said, nah, nobody cares. So I haven't spoken to Mark since the miniseries has been on, but it was his opinion nobody would care.
You know, talking about the book, it's my opinion is O.J. Simpson was a media whore, that he all the time wanted somehow to tell people what he did, and because he's a sensationalist. Do you think with that book that was written, he said, well, if I would have done it, that was his confession?
Yeah, I mean, you remember what happened there. There was a woman named Judith Regan who ran an imprint of HarperCollins, which was owned by News Corporation, which owns Fox. And when she was going to put out that book, Corporation suddenly woke up one morning and said, no, we're not putting out this book. And we're done with Judith Regan, and there was a big giant fight, and she left, and the imprint was closed down. So that book, though when released, had a ripple effect on not only O.J., but Judith Regan and News Corporation and a lot of people.
Didn't they take the jury to the house in Brentwood? Didn't they do the whole drive, and then they took the jury to the home?
Yes, they did. They went on a field trip, and I think they went on the Stations of the Cross. They went to O.J.'s house, and they went to Bundy, and they went to Gretna Green, and they did all that stuff, yeah.
Yeah. So, again, what I find fascinating, I mean, I lived through it, Bob, we all lived through it, but technology, and really that was the first time we heard of DNA. With the internet today, do you think that trial would be as big as it is today? If we were living in present time, would that case draw this attention?
Oh, yeah, sure. I do. As a matter of fact, it's not so much the internet, it's cable TV. I think that trial proved to NBC and Rupert Murdoch that you could cover something 24 hours a day endlessly if it was big enough, and convince them to go into the cable news business to compete with CNN. I think that trial led directly to what we now know as cable news.
Good point.
If it were happening again today, you know, would it be even bigger because of the proliferation of websites and the internet? Yeah, but I think that, you know, you can't think of it as the dark ages. I mean, there was an incident you talked about, O.J., you know, running from Kardashian's house, got in the Bronco without Collins and went on his little run. I was down at Parker Center waiting for him to arrive. We knew they were going out to arrest him, take him into custody, bring him down, arraign him. And I'm down there doing live shots, one after another, after another, after another. And all of a sudden we hear, oh, O.J.'s missing. O.J.'s on the road. O.J.'s, you know, leading the cops on this chase. And there's a reporter, and Bob's in L.A., he knows this guy, is Conan Nolan at KNBC. Mm-hmm. And I saw Conan walking through Parker Center with a phone to his ear. And I thought, I wonder where Conan's going. This is where all the action is. Well, within about 20 minutes, Conan was behind O.J. doing cell phone reports with the NBC helicopter overhead, focused on O.J., the cops, and there's our guy right behind them. It was one of the more remarkable acrobatics I've ever seen a local reporter do. So they were the technology in L.A. at the time was not what we have today, but it was very thorough. I mean, they could bounce live shots off of mountaintops and onto the air from essentially San Diego to Bakersfield, and didn't need satellites, although we had satellites. It just didn't need them. LA was so wired up with microwaves that they could do continuous, because there were literally no hole in Southern California where they couldn't get a picture out of. And I think that, you know, we're back to this, the effect of the trial. I think that convinced people who were ready to invest $1 billion in cable startups. I think that convinced them that it could be done and it was time to do it.
John, I have a question for you.
Who got famous off of it? You know, Court TV came from the O.J. trial. So many of these reports. That was the first time I ever saw Greta Van Susteren, I think, was reporting on the O.J. trial.
Yes.
Go ahead, Bob.
John, I have a question for you. Now, a lot of people speculate that Bob Kardashian came on the legal team because he knew a lot of things and that would give him cover. He wouldn't have to testify. Is that, do you agree with that?
Probably, yeah.
They talk about that in the miniseries. He went and he wasn't even a licensed lawyer at the time. He had let his license go.
No.
He, on the advice of Johnny Cochran, went and got his license renewed so he could sit on the defense team because it would look good because he was OJ's friend.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, look, they tied up the OJ. This was a victory, you know, the first time that a black man had enough green to overcome the legal power of a government. And they tied up a lot of lawyers on OJ's side. And I can imagine, I don't know, but I can imagine that, yeah, Kardashian was a close enough friend, best to get him on the legal team so he couldn't be called to the stand.
All these other theories, John, about potentially who else might have committed the murder. Maybe it was Jason, his son. Do you buy any of that stuff at all, or that he might have had?
I did. I did. I thought that was a real possibility. The thing that sealed it for me was in the civil trial with the Bruno Mali shoes. There wasn't any way for anybody else to have left those particular footprints in the blood than OJ and that pair of shoes. And
they even in the trial went all the way down to where they showed the receipt that Nicole bought those shoes for him, and they had the receipt that those were his shoes, and not everybody walks around in Bruno Mali. I mean, there was just so much stuff. I just have to say on a personal note, I had the biggest crush on Mark Furman. Oh, my gosh, I had such a crush on him. That is why I married to a cop. My first husband was not a cop. Now my second husband is a cop. So when I see my husband in his dress suit and his gun and his badge, it just takes me back to those Mark Furman days because I just thought he was darling. I loved him. That's my take on the OJ case,
right? They had to make somebody a fall guy, and they made Furman a fall guy. That script that he was working on gave him the chance to do that. Johnny Cochran was very smart to not do the cross-examination himself. He had Effley Bailey do it, and you'll remember that dramatic moment when Effley Bailey said, Detective Furman, Marine to Marine, you have never said the N-word. That was, in a lot of ways, that was a pretty heavy-duty moment for that jury.
Mm-hmm.
I think Mark Furman was a great cop. I mean, great detective. It's unfortunate that they that he was taken down like that, and they diverted the focus on him and as opposed to the trial, isn't it?
Well, you have to put somebody else on trial, and that's what they chose to do. And I think they realized they had some stuff on Furman. I don't know at what point they discovered that script. It may have been after they decided to concentrate on Furman, but once they had that movie script thing that he'd been working on with that woman, that was it. He was on the bullseye.
Yeah. And it was terrible. So as my husband is a police officer, almost 20-year veteran. We were talking about this the other night. It's a totally different world because the police were called out to the Simpson residence 8 or 9 times with Nicole, and they were called out with his first wife and now several times. And never arrested him. My husband said, now, you wouldn't even have to hit anyone. If you feel he is threatening you, you're going to jail. So I think we've come a long way as far as domestic violence and men getting away with it. But he skated 8 confirmed times, and there were photos of her beat in the face. And imagine a man of his size punching her in the face, and he got away with it. So what does that tell you?
Well, it just told me, look, Johnny Cochran's job was to make O.J. black again. He had been he had whitened himself through his career and his movies and his life in Brentwood and his wife and his kids and you know, they just had to make I think at the time O.J. was first arrested, there probably was not a lot of sympathy for him in the black community. He'd gone white. They had to make him black again. The history of domestic violence you're talking about, you're absolutely right. That would not be these days. That wouldn't be countenanced at all. But at the time, he was a big star, and he was a friend of the cops, and they came to his house, and, you know, they knew him personally, and, yeah, they let him slide on a lot of stuff.
You know, I have a quick story of O.J. I'm a native San Franciscan, born and raised, and my ex-husband, native San Franciscan, he's quite a bit older than I am, and O.J. Simpson went to high school, Galileo High School in San Francisco in the Marina. He lived on Potrero Hill, which is in the projects, and he went to Galileo. He was a big football star in high school. My ex-husband had friends that played football with him and knew him. And in high school, he was signing autographs for the cops and getting away with stuff. He was a punk. And I'm talking kids, I'm grown men now, that went to high school with him, and he was just always a punk. He was getting in trouble all the time. The cops let him get away with it. He'd sign autographs in high school. I mean, he was getting that kind of brain enhancement, ego in high school.
That doesn't surprise me. San Francisco had a similar kind of cop culture as L.A., and that doesn't surprise me a bit.
Yeah, well, we're not proud, you know, there's nothing even in San Francisco, you wouldn't even know he came from San Francisco anymore. I mean, didn't they bulldoze the house in Brentwood, too? Somebody bought the property and they bulldozed the house and built a new home?
The house in Rockingham, yes, they did.
Yeah, that's a nice. How do you think that made him feel?
Well, I mean, if you buy the house in Brentwood, I mean, you know, Jay Simpson's house, you're essentially buying the lot. I mean, who wants to live in that house?
Right. So do you remember, both of you, do you remember, like, when they would have news? I was trying to explain to my children who are 29 and 25. My daughter remembers. She says, oh, I remember coming home from school and you were always watching the O.J. trial. But, you know, she doesn't remember, obviously, the details. But do you remember when they would have, like, a newscast? Okay, our 6 o'clock newscast will not include any O.J. Simpson news for your entertainment. You know, they would literally have, like, okay, we're going to have a 30-minute news segment, no O.J. And if you don't want to, because it was every day from the minute you woke up to the minute you went to bed. And Jay Leno, remember he had, I think it was Jay Leno, maybe David Letterman, the dancing Judge Ito's. And, you know, it really became a circus, right? You were in the tent, right, John?
Oh, absolutely. It was Leno had the dancing Ito's. I remember some news organizations trying to avoid O.J. It never worked. They would say, okay, yeah, we're going to do O.J. news tonight, and they'd watch their ratings just fall off the table and say, okay, that's what they want. Give it to them, and they'd go back to it.
But again, that was a time when we had to go home and watch the news. Like, I can remember picking my kids up in carpool. I got to go because they're going to show the glove. Bye. I got to get out of here. The glove. And then everybody had to get the Globe magazine because the death pictures were there. And everybody, you know, it was like we were more attached to where nowadays we just look at our phone and get the updates and, you know, it'd be a part of our daily. You know, I don't know if I would sit and watch a whole trial like I did the summer of O.J.
It probably has changed a bit, look, if TV wanted to get people to watch, I just guess that they'd change the way they approach it. But I suspect that if the same thing were occurring today, it would still be you know, must see TV.
Right.
John, do you think that that Judge Ito lost control of the courtroom and that he let the defense team kind of control and dictate things? Could he have done things a little bit differently?
You know, I'm not a lawyer. You know, he said constantly over and over and over and over, I am here to ensure justice. So if they had motions, if they had wanted sidebars, if they wanted any kind of nitpicky detail thing that required everything stop and deal with that, whatever that issue was, he let them do it. Was that a mistake? Were they controlling things? I guess. But I honestly don't know what else he would have done. I mean, you can kind of imagine some heavy-handed judge saying, you know, no, I'm not going to hear that. And then all of the legal commentators would have said, well, there's the issue for appeal. I mean, I think he was kind of in a corner. I'm not sure what else he could have done.
Do you remember how many sidebars there was? Always a sidebar. They must have had 50 a day. We all learned what a sidebar was.
Yeah, I mean, all of the OJ paraphernalia that was produced, T-shirts, coffee cups, there was one famous button that was the word sidebars with that no signal through it, the circle with the line.
Mm-hmm.
It got out of hand, and it exasperated lots and lots of people, including me, but I just don't know what the judge really would have done, what he could have done any different.
Let me ask this one question, Maureen, if you mind. So, John, I mean, do you think in today's world, with the media covering things and with the experience of the OJ trial and then Michael Jackson, can any of these celebrities who get under fire like this ever get a real fair trial?
Well, what's fair? I mean,
yeah.
They don't want to go to jail, so they apply their resources to it, and they certainly think it's fair. I mean, the rest of us may not, but no. Look, it's money. If you've got the money to employ lawyers like this. Yeah, you can stretch things out a long way.
Yeah, well, it sucked him dry, basically. I think he pretty much became broke after the trial. I mean, he was free, and then he was proven guilty in the civil, you know, in the civil trial, and then he proceeded to do what he's doing, which has landed him in jail in Las Vegas. So, you know, it's interesting as we look back at almost 20 years. Kardashian is dead, Johnny Cochran's dead, OJ's in jail for something completely different, but he's suffering, which we all know. I mean, the shock of the not guilty verdict, we could only hope he would end up getting his just due, and he did. So where were you, John, when I'm assuming you were in your director's chair when the jury said, we have a verdict, and tell us that.
Yeah, well, it was, you know, we certainly knew there was a verdict coming. It was going to be read, and I was sitting in that director's chair on that platform 45 feet above the parking lot, and the jury read the verdict, and the world went nuts, and I think I don't remember who I was on with, but they said, does this surprise you? And I said, no, not really. It doesn't. And I'm still
not surprised. You were calm. And you were calm, you are now.
Yes, I was calm. I was a news person. you're supposed to stay calm.
Maureen, I remember I was at, when I was still working for Keebler, I was at a Vons grocery store down here in Southern California. And when I was doing my job in the grocery store, and then all of a sudden they said, oh, everybody go in the break room. They're going to announce the verdict. And it was packed in the room there with all the workers and some most employees. When that verdict went out, I was in South Central LA. They were screaming and yelling and celebrating and hooting and hollering. I was very quickly exiting the store. I was getting out as quickly as I could. I didn't want to get beat up on. But
well, I remember they said they have a verdict and we will read it tomorrow at 10 a.m. So
yep.
That was another cliffhanger, right? And I think, well, I don't know, but probably they just wanted everyone to go home and they didn't want a big riot, you know, that night. So they read the verdict at 10 in the morning. My ex-husband at the time never missed a day of work, never. Stayed home. This is, again, a sign of how different things were. He stayed home. We were sitting on the couch, came out, not guilty. 10 minutes after 10 a.m., he pops the beer. Never have I seen him have a drink before 5 o'clock. He's like, I got to have a beer. I can't handle this. And that's my memory of he's not guilty. And then things spiraled again out of that. It became more, you know, the fascination with him just continued to grow. Would you agree, John?
Yes and no. I mean, I think that, obviously it was a big a controversy for a long time and people argued about it, and it led to a lot of the racial divide and suspicion we see today. But I think the actual interest in O.J. subsided and look, the next thing that happened was that civil trial, and I was there covering that thing too, and that pretty much established beyond anybody's normal doubts that he had done it.
I had forgotten you would have had to, you would cover that trial as well. I had forgotten that you had to go through that too, but that was not quite as long. So
it was.
John,
we have a few minutes left, and just quickly, what I've taken from it, I've seen recent pictures of OJ and Nicole's daughter. She looks, you know, just such a sad case. She's living in Florida. I guess they try to stay out of the limelight. I don't know about his other kids with his first wife, but the ones that were raised by the Brown family, you know, just a shame. And to think that he did this and he left those bodies there for those kids to wake up in the morning and come downstairs and see it. I mean, to be so horrific. That's what I took out of it. And that's what I took out of, you know, watching the first episodes. And then, John, you posted that on your Facebook. You have a picture of you in the trailer covering the trial for 18 months. And I just thought, we have to get this guy on. I want to hear what it was like to really be in the middle of it all.
Well, I'll just tell you this in closing, that I had been a local news reporter for close to 20 years when this happened. And I had never been on a story longer than, I don't know, 3 weeks, maybe an earthquake or something. That you do the coverage and the aftermath and the cleanup and so forth. I'd never been on any story longer than a few weeks. When this happened, I realized this is going to go on longer than anything I've ever seen, and I might as well just strap myself in and do it, because it was going to be huge, and that's really what it turned out to be. I mean, it's not just that I did it for 18 months. I did it 7 days a week for 18 months. And
Now, do you think it helped your career, though, John? Do you think it boosted you?
Without a doubt. I had a job doing live shots on local news, working for the network, but doing local news. And all of a sudden, 18 months later, I go to New York to work on this network that Roger Ailes was running, that was a subsidiary of CNBC. Because the whole thing with me was the Rivera Live Show. That's what really gave me my big boost, and on CNBC. And that became, very quickly after I arrived, that became MSNBC. And I worked there for 4 more years, and then I went to Fox. And so, no, without question, the OJ thing was the biggest episode in my news career.
Wow, who would have thought? A kid from Potrero Hill. John, thank you so much for joining us. And I hope we can have you back again and talk about something else besides the OJ trial.
Okay, well, thank you for having me.
Thanks,
okay,
John.
Okay, have a great day.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So, that ends another episode, Bob. We will be live again next Friday
awesome.
At 4 o'clock. Yeah, John's
awesome.
A great guy. So, thanks, everybody, and we'll be live.
I just wanted to throw one more thing out there, Maureen. Thank you so much for bringing him in, and I'm so happy for you and you're moving to your new place, and you just things are just going great for you so far, 2016.
Thank you, and you know what? I really hope you come up and visit us. We're having a big 4th of July bash. All our listeners can come. Just come join us. But I hope you can make a trip up and come and see us. We're having a big 4th of July.
I want a belly flop in your new pool.
All right. I'll turn on the water slide for you.
There we go.
All right. Well, thanks again, everyone. Thanks for listening to California Connection. Bob, you're my hero. Keep the streak going. I will see you next Friday at 4 o'clock.
Thank you, Maureen. Bye-bye. God bless all the soldiers, and happy President's Day to everybody.
And happy Valentine's Day.
Thank you, you too. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.